You're listening to Stories from General Conference on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Faith is the first principle of the gospel. Because we have had a veil of forgetfulness pulled over our minds, we must walk through life without perfect knowledge and understanding. We cannot formulate memories of our premortal life and our relationships there. We cannot remember the council in heaven, where we stood up valiantly and defended our Heavenly Father's plan. We cannot remember living and growing as brothers and sisters under the loving care of our Father. Though we cannot remember these things, it does not mean that they cannot be meaningful to us in our lives. The Lord has given us the principle of faith, the ability to believe and feel something that we cannot see, either with our eyes or our memory. As we are faithful to our covenants before the Lord, we will be blessed with greater faith. Faith can bring to pass many mighty miracles. Although we do not always see or understand the reasons or results of our actions, as we believe we will be blessed, it is through faith alone that true miracles can be performed. President Thomas S. Monson, during his April 1978 conference address, shared a number of inspiring stories demonstrating the power of faith and the accompanying miracles.
I remember that some years ago, I had the opportunity to visit the Australia Mission, and in company with the mission president, flew to Darwin, there to break ground for that city's first Latter-day Saint chapel. En route, however, the plane touched down at a small mining community called Mount Isa. And there by the modest terminal, we were met by a beautiful mother and her two children of primary age. She introduced herself to us as Judith Loudon and mentioned that she and her children were the only members of the church in the entire town. She said that her husband Richard was not a member. Right then and there, we held a meeting. And I emphasized to the mother the importance of home primary. I told her that when I returned to headquarters, I would arrange for materials pertaining to the home primary to be sent to her. We received a commitment to meet, to pray, to persevere in faith. When I did return home, I enlisted the help of then-President Laverne Parmley, and the materials for the home primary were sent to Australia, along with a complimentary subscription to the Children's Friend. Years passed, and again I found myself in Brisbane, Australia, speaking to the priesthood leadership of a state quarterly conference. I happened to mention to the priesthood leaders the plight of that good woman and her children, and then made the comment, "I wonder if I'll ever know whether or not that home primary succeeded. Oh, how I would like to meet the non-member husband of such a choice woman and the father of such lovely children." A hand was raised in the rear, and a person stood and said, "Elder Monson, my name is Richard Loudon. I am the husband of that good woman and the father of those choice children. Prayer and primary brought me into the church." Heartwarming is the account of the American mother who prayed fervently for her son as the ship on which he served sailed into that bloody cauldron known as the Pacific Theater of War. Every morning as she would arise from bended knee in her prayer, she would then take her place as a volunteer on the production line, which became a lifeline to men in battle. Could it be that a mother's handiwork could somehow affect the life of a loved one? All who knew her and her family cherished the account of her sailor son, Elgin Staples. His ship went down off Guadalcanal, and Staples was swept overboard. But he survived because of a life belt, which proved on later examination to have been inspected, packed and stamped back home in Akron, Ohio, by his own mother. A long time ago, I was assigned to the Grand Junction, Colorado State Quarterly Conference. And while there, the state president asked if I would meet with a grieving mother and father whose son had announced that he was going to return home from the mission field, although he had been there but a week. After the conference throng had departed, we sought out a quiet place, and there mother and father, state president and I, knelt in prayer. As I offered that prayer, I could hear the muffled sobs of a grieving mother and a disappointed father. And after we arose from our knees, the father looked at me and said, "I don't see how our Heavenly Father could possibly alter my son's determination to return home. I don't know why it is, but now for the first time in my life that I have really tried to live the commandments, it seems as though my prayers are not answered." I said to him, "Where is your son serving?" He said, "In Dusseldorf, Germany." I put one arm around mother and another arm around father. And I said to them, "My dear brother and sister, your prayers are already being answered. Today there are 28 state quarterly conferences being attended by general authorities. And I received the assignment to your stake. Of all the general authorities, I am the only one who has the assignment to speak to the missionaries in Dusseldorf, Germany, this very Thursday." Their plea had been heard, and that Thursday I met with their son, and I told him of the concern which his parents had for them and for him. Another prayer was offered. A blessing was provided. Of course, he remained and filled an honorable mission. More years went by, and again I returned to Grand Junction, Colorado State. And again, I met the same mother and father. Still, father had not qualified to take mother and the children to the Holy Temple. I emphasized to them that if they would fervently pray, the way would be opened up for those eternal temple blessings to be theirs, and they could be a forever family. I indicated that I would be pleased to officiate the night they came to the temple. Mother pleaded, father strived, children urged, and they all prayed. What was the result? Let me share with you a letter which their tiny son, Todd, placed under the pillow of his father on Father's Day morning. The boy is quite a psychologist and a budding journalist. He said, "Dad, I love you for what you are and not for what you aren't. Why don't you stop smoking? Millions of people have. Why can't you? It's harmful to your health, to your lungs, your heart. If you can't keep the word of wisdom, you can't go to heaven with me and Skip and Brad and Mark and Jeff and Jeannie and Pam and their families. Us kids keep the word of wisdom. Why can't you? You're stronger and you're a man. Dad, I want to see you in heaven. We all do. We want to be a whole family in heaven, not a half a one. And Dad, you and Mom ought to get two old bikes and start riding around the park every night. You're probably laughing right now, but I wouldn't be. You laugh at those old people jogging around the park and riding bikes and walking. But they're going to outlive you because they're exercising their lungs and their hearts and their muscles. They're going to have the last laugh. Come on, Dad. Be a good guy. Don't smoke or drink or anything else against our religion. We want you at our graduation. If you do quit smoking and do good stuff like us, you and Mom can go with Brother Monson and get married and sealed to us in the temple. Come on, Dad. Mom and us kids are just waiting for you. We want to live with you forever. We love you. You're the greatest dad. Love, Todd." And then he wrote, "P.S. And if the rest of us wrote one of these, they'd say the same thing. He couldn't quit. He then wrote PPS. Mr. Newton has quit smoking. So can you. You're closer to God than Mr. Newton. That plea, that prayer of faith, was heard and answered. A night that I shall ever treasure and long remember was when that family assembled in the ceiling room of the temple which graces this square. Mother was there, father was there, every child was there, all dressed in white, and sacred eternal ordinances were performed. The memorable evening was brought to a close by a humble kneeling prayer.
Faith is more than just belief. It is a principle of action. The faith that burns inside of us should prompt us to do things, things that may normally be more difficult. Elder Hugh B. Brown of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, during his April 1972 conference address, shared a personal experience from his mission when he acted in faith.
Many things have been said about missionaries and missionary work, and that has been the first love of my life. And I have been reminded of several things that happened 68 years ago when I went to England. One I should like to relate. I had gone to a certain house several times and been rejected and warned not to come back again. But I was prompted to go again and again. And then my last visit, as I was attempting to walk past that house, I was prompted to go in and try again to make contact. I used the big brass knocker on the English door without any response. I could see the lady sitting in the front room knitting, and I made considerable noise with that knocker. She did not come out, and I went around the back door. There was no knocker on that door, so I used my walking stick, and I knocked with considerable vigor. In fact, it echoed through all the house. Very soon, the lady came out, and her coming out reminded me of my early days on the farm when I would tease a setting hen off of the nest. I see some of you have had farm experience, and you know that a setting hen, when she's teased off the nest, comes out with her feathers going in the wrong direction, with her beak in perpetual motion. And this woman reminded me of that. I apologized and said, I'm sorry to have interrupted you and have insisted on an interview. But my dear sister, I have come over 6,000 miles to bring you a message which the Lord wants you to have. He sent me here to give you that message. And I'm going back to Canada in a few days, and I must tell you what the Lord wants you to know. She said, you mean the Lord sent a message to me? I said, that's it, right. He did. What is it? And I told her the restoration of the gospel, the organization of the church, and the message of the restoration. She was quite impressed by what I told her. And I told her when I left her, I'm sorry to have disturbed you, but I could not refuse to carry out the message and the mission that was given to me when I came here to bring to you. And when we meet again, and we will meet again, you're going to say thank you for coming to my back door. Thank you for loving me enough to carry the message of the Lord to me. When you left, I could hardly contain myself. I was worried, disturbed, and wondered what it was all about. But I finally went to the mission home, got some literature, studied, and became a member of the church with my family. 10 years later, I was in England again, this time as a soldier. At the end of the meeting, a lady came up with 2 grown daughters. She says, "I do thank God and thank you that you came to my door with that message many years ago." She says, "I and my daughters joined the church and we're going to Utah in a short time. And we thank God that you had the courage, the fortitude, and the faith to come to me with that divine message and leave it with me in the name of the Lord."
Faith can be a great tool as we seek to share our testimonies with others. In his October 1975 General Conference address, Elder A. Theodore Tuttle spoke of the power of faith in missionary work.
"We had a neighbor boy who regularly passed our place headed for the mailbox, impatiently awaiting his letter of call. It seemed unusually long in coming after his recommendation was sent in. I observed this scene the day his letter came. He opened it at the mailbox, called his friend over, and they rejoiced together. Then he figuratively bounced down the lane to share the good news with his family. A few minutes later, his 16-year-old sister came strolling by, headed home. I merely mentioned in a greeting that her brother had received his mission call. She instantly changed her pace and ran all the way home to join in the excitement of her brother's call. Think of the anticipation, the joy that gladdens hundreds of homes and hundreds of hearts each week, for this is a family call. Not only does this service bless the homes from which missionaries come, it blesses lives where missionaries go. While we lived in South America, our eldest son reached the age to fill a mission. He was the first missionary to leave our little branch, composed mainly of converts. The closing prayer at his farewell was offered by one of the new converts. He expressed this thought: Heavenly Father, we've seen missionaries come, and they have blessed our lives. Now we see that we must send missionaries. Help us to rear our sons to serve." That prayer of faith was answered. When that man's son was 19, he was called to go to Italy. I received this note about him from the president of the branch where he labored. "We have known Elder Labanora since he arrived 6 months ago. In the short time he has been here, he has baptized 9 people. Because you knew him before, I share a little experience. We were visiting one of our sick members in the hospital. In the ward of about 20 people, there was a 3-year-old boy whose mother had abandoned him when he was born. He has had no one to love him. The child was playing in his crib and needed his nose wiped. So Elder Labanora wiped his nose with the tenderness of a real father, held him in his arms for a minute, kissed him, and put him gently back in bed. The expression on the child's face was a mixture of surprise and security. We believe this young man is the greatest missionary we have seen. What a blessing he is to our mission and branch. It is a further evidence of faith to note that President Labanora, the father who prayed that they could rear their sons to serve, has since sent his 2nd son into the mission field. Now, brothers and sisters, we face another challenge: to become missionaries. We have not been as successful in doing this as we have been in providing missionaries. This is an opportunity for all of us to exercise this 2nd kind of faith. We need to set personal and family goals. Make the achievement of these goals a matter of earnest prayer. Exercise our faith in God and cause success to come. 18 months ago, President Kimball said, "In our stake in district missionary work, we have hardly scratched the surface. I believe the time has come when we must change our sights and raise our goals." Stake missionary work is a great sleeping giant, but it is beginning to stir. We now expect all stake presidents to give greater attention to this work, to do 3 things. Develop stake goals. See that your 70s are organized correctly and functioning properly in order to assist every family to share the gospel with another. In this work, every member must lengthen his stride, as we heard described so beautifully this morning about our leader. There is a place for everyone in the church to serve as a missionary, either at home or abroad, for people on this side of the veil or on the other. 18 months ago, one man expressed his faith that missionary work would be improved, become more efficient and more productive. At that time, it seemed impossible. Immediately, however, his counselors joined their faith with his faith, and it was trebled. Then the 12 joined with them, and church leaders and many members have compounded that faith again and again. Faith called forth faith, and a mighty work moves forward.
Elder Boyd K. Packer of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles, during his October 1974 address, spoke of the sustaining blessing of faith during times of trial.
In the late 1850s, many converts from Europe were struggling to reach the Great Salt Lake Valley. Many were too poor to afford the oxen and the covered wagons and had to walk, pushing their meager belongings in hand carts. Some of the most touching and tragic moments in the history of the church accompanied these handcart pioneers. One such company was commanded by Brother MacArthur. Archer Walters, an English convert who was with the company, recorded in his diary under July the 2nd, 1858, this sentence: "Brother Parker's little boy, age 6, was lost, and the father went back to hunt him." The boy, Arthur, was next youngest of 4 children of Robert and Ann Parker. 3 days earlier, the company had stopped in the face of a sudden thunderstorm. It was then the little boy was missed. The parents had thought him to be playing along the way with the other children. Someone remembered that earlier in the day, when they had stopped, that they had seen the little boy settle down to rest under the shade of some brush. Now, most of you have little children, and you know how quickly a tired little 6-year-old could fall asleep on a sultry summer day, and how soundly he could sleep that even the noise of the camp moving on might not awaken him. Well, for 2 days, the camp remained, the company remained, and all of the men searched for him. Then on July the 2nd, with no alternative, the company was ordered west. Robert Parker, as the diary records, went back alone to search once more for his little son. As he was leaving camp, his wife pinned a bright shawl about his shoulders with words such as these: "If you find him dead, wrap him in this to bury him. If you find him alive, you could use this as a flag to signal us." She, with the other little children, took the hand cart and struggled along with the company. Out on the trail each night, Ann Parker kept watch. At sundown on July the 5th, as they were watching, they saw a figure approaching from the east. And then, in the rays of the setting sun, she saw the glimmer of the bright red shawl. One of the diaries records, "Ann Parker fell in a pitiful heap upon the sand, and that night, for the first time in 6 nights, she slept." Under July the 5th, Brother Walters recorded, "Brother Parker came into camp with a little boy that had been lost. Great joy through the camp. The mother's joy I cannot describe." We do not know all of the details. The nameless woodsman, I've often wondered how unlikely it was that a woodsman should be there, but he found the little boy and described him as being sick with illness and with terror, and he cared for him until his father found him. So here a story commonplace in its day ends, except for a question: how would you in Ann Parker's place feel towards the nameless woodsman had he saved your little son? Would there be any end to your gratitude, To sense this is to feel something of the gratitude our Father must feel toward any of us who saves one of his children. Such gratitude is a prize dearly to be won, for the Lord has said, if it so be that you should labor all of your days, and bring save it be one soul, in crying repentance unto this people, and bring save it be one soul, and to me how great shall be your joy with him in the kingdom of my Father. Even so, I might add, if that soul should be our own.
In the history of our church, truly no one can serve as a better collective example of faith and devotion than the pioneers. Just like the pioneers, we are called to put one foot in front of the other, often not knowing beforehand what we should do. This is the nature of faith, to believe without seeing, to trust in the Lord. In an April 1979 General Conference address, President Marion G. Romney, second counselor in the first presidency, shared the story of great faith shown by President Heber J. Grant as a young man.
President Grant's boundless faith that the Lord would prosper those who were liberal with their means in building the kingdom has had a distinct effect upon me in my life personally. Many years ago, I heard him tell about attending a fast meeting at which the bishop made an appeal for donations. President Grant, though a very young man, had $50 in his pocket, which he intended to deposit in the bank. But he was so impressed by the bishop's appeal that he tendered the whole $50. The bishop took $5 and handed him back the $45, stating that $5 was his full share. President Grant replied, "Bishop Woolley, by what right do you rob me of putting the Lord in my debt? Didn't you preach here today that the Lord rewards fourfold? My mother is a widow, and she needs $200. My boy," queried the bishop, "do you believe that if I take this other $45, you will get your $200 quicker?" "Certainly," replied President Grant. Here was a demonstration of faith which the bishop himself couldn't withstand. He took the remaining $45. President Grant testified that on his way home that day, fast meeting, back to work, an idea popped into his head, acting upon which he made $218.50. Speaking about this incident years later, he said, "Someone will say that it would have happened anyway. I do not think it would have happened. I do not think it would have. I would have got the idea," he said. "I am a firm believer that the Lord opens up the windows of heaven when we do our duty financially and pours out upon us blessings of a spiritual nature which are of far greater value than temporal blessings. But I believe he also gives us blessings of a temporal nature."
Faith in the Lord will give us strength to overcome anything that may come our way. This very life that we live is an opportunity to prove our faith through everyday actions. Though we may push forward in faith, we may not receive the blessings in the manner that we expect. This can be yet another powerful opportunity to show even more faith in the wisdom of our Father, who sees infinitely beyond our gaze. During his October 1978 address, Elder John H. Groberg of the First Quorum of the 70 spoke of a unique challenge faced by a faithful family.
"For example, I have always been moved as I have seen those who are required to operate on less than their full faculties. I, along with some of you, have asked the question, why? On many occasions, when an accident has occurred or a terrible illness or an untimely death, or when a mentally retarded or physically handicapped child has been born, or some other seemingly difficult to explain situation has taken place, people have come to me and to others wanting reassurance. I, along with you, have taken great consolation in the scriptures as they tell us that not even a sparrow falls to the ground without our Father knowing. We believe the scriptures, but when it happens to our loved one or to our friend, the question of why still rings. I do not have all the answers, but hopefully the following experience, which happened several years ago, may be helpful to some who are still battling the question of why. On a small Pacific island, an infant girl was born to a faithful family. They called her Felila. There was happiness and joy as this grateful spirit made her debut into mortal life, but soon there were problems. Her head was abnormally large. The doctors diagnosed it as hydroencephalitis. The questions of brain damage, of normalcy, of other problems, all raised their haunting heads. After much fasting and prayer, the elders' quorum president approached the branch president, who in turn talked with the district president, who after adequate checking came to me as the mission president to see if there were some additional help available. The medical authorities were consulted, and it was determined that there was little, if anything, they could do locally. Letters were written, information was sent back and forth, x-rays were taken. There was so much to do. These x-rays had to be analyzed, so many questions to be answered, so many pieces to fit together. Finally, after exasperatingly long delays, things began to fall into place. A family here in Salt Lake agreed to accept full responsibility for the infant, even if it meant years of outpatient care. The doctors agreed on the possibility of her eventual recovery. The hospital accepted the case on a service basis. Funds were raised for her airfare. Some local travelers arranged their schedules to bring her right to the hospital. But there were other problems: visas, health certificates, reservations, passports. All during these trying days, the family, the elders' quorum, and even the whole branch continued to fast and pray. The time of departure of the infrequent plane grew near. One morning, amidst myriads of other pressing matters, I had a strong impression that I must take the time now and put forth the extra effort required to get everything done so she could go. I got on the overseas telephone. The consulate finally agreed to issue a visa. The airlines made a special reservation. The passport people agreed to waive the normal regulations. Others gave that extra effort and cooperation, and soon all was in order. Normally, I would have sent someone to bring the family in to sign the final papers, but again, I felt strongly impressed that I should personally go and see the branch president. I located him in the early afternoon near the school where he was teaching. He was standing alone outside as though he were waiting for me. Excitedly, I ran up to him. "Guess what? It's all set. Miraculously, everything has worked out, and Felila can leave tomorrow. Please get word to the family immediately." His calm, penetrating gaze quelled my exuberance. "It's true," I said. "I know it's been long, and there have been lots of disappointments, but she really is going now. What's the matter?" His steady gaze seemed to penetrate my very soul. Then softly, in his liquid native tongue, he informed me that when all the preparations had been made, when the hearts of so many had been stretched in service, when the goal of unity and selflessness had been achieved in those many hearts, when all had made the final commitment of others above self, at the height of all this activity, that very morning, little Felila had quietly and unobtrusively slipped away, gone to that better care which so many had fasted and prayed and worked so long and hard for her to receive. Gone this morning? But all that work, all that time, all that fasting and praying and those strong feelings, gone? No. Without once shifting his gaze, he, having more faith than me, offered a few words of truth and encouragement, then quietly turned and rejoined his class. And I was left alone, or so it seemed. I moved slowly and heavily down that dusty trail. Why? Why? After all that work and that strong faith of so many and those impressions, why? I sensed the brightness of the sun and felt the warmth of the breeze as it lazily tossed the palm leaves and slowly shifted the silent clouds against the clear blue sky. A feeling came over me. I realized that the earth was beautiful, that life went on and was eternal. And while I cannot describe fully what happened next, part of the experience is proper to relate. The best explanation is contained in the phrase, I was overcome by the Spirit. It was as though one took me by the hand and led me to a high place and stood by me and said, Look. And I looked and beheld such beauty and magnificence as man cannot conceive. And I heard a voice, such a tender, compassionate voice, yet so unmistakably powerful that all nature stood still and listened and obeyed. Come home, Felila, my daughter. Come home to the care your loved ones have sought for you. I have heard their prayers and have known their fasting and love for you, and I answer, Come home, my daughter. You have finished your mission in life. Hearts have been softened. Souls have been stretched. Faith has been increased. Come home now, Felila. He knew her. He knew her name. He knew all about her and about all those others. How perfect our Father's love. He had heard the prayers. He had done what was best. He knew everything. Which thing, though I believed, I never had supposed. In some marvelous way, which is beyond our mortal comprehension, he knows and understands all things. My questions as to why, as to justice and reasons, were all at that moment completely swept away. They were so irrelevant, my questioning so totally out of place, like one trying to dig the Grand Canyon with a teaspoon.
We hope you've enjoyed this latest episode of Stories from General Conference on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.